Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter. I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Maricela Garza. Hey, ladies.
Hello.
How's it going? We're seeing little bits of spring.
Yay. Crocuses. I came to work without a coat yesterday, but not today. But yeah.
I mean, okay.
It was colder yesterday.
Yeah, it was colder. Really?
Sometimes I'm just like, I think I can do it. Just the sweater.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no. And then inside we're freezing. But, you know,
yeah,
it's just the way the world works.
It is. Yep.
So we have kind of a wide-ranging set of titles to talk about today. And I'm not going to get started.
I'm going to get started because it's March, and everyone knows what March is. It's March is reading month time.
Yay.
This is the time, of course, when not just in our libraries, but especially in schools, you see particularly like younger grades and teachers celebrating this way of reading, like practicing reading every day in whatever way you want. Here at Capital Area District Libraries, we are wild about reading. That is our theme, loosely, this month. We've got lots of events going on at all of our branches. And we also have a little March is Reading Month. It's not really a calendar this year. It's like a bingo sheet. And it's just got little, you know, fun things to do. You know, you can pick what to do. You can pick up a prize if you really want to. At any branch by April 18th, but just things like, you know, read a book that you love or read a book about a bear. I think I want to do that one. So, there's lots of fun things that parents can do with their children at home or even in the library, writing down three words that rhyme. So speaking of rhyming, I'm going to bring my first book, which, oh my goodness, I am absolutely in love. Words with Wings and Magic Things, poems by Matthew Burgess and pictures by Doug Salati. Both of these creators are just amazing award winners, I might say. This is a book of poetry with several different sections. There's lots. And each section begins with a W. So we're talking about things like welcome, windows, whoops and wallops. That's one of my favorite sections. But these are just, this book really got my attention because especially as I'm thinking about like March is Reading Month and parents reading with their children, particularly if you're at a point where you're like, you know, reading with your child at night and you want to have your child go back and forth where you're reading and then your child is reading with you. So it's like, you know, read to me, I read to you sort of format. This is a perfect book for that. The poems were just amazing. Jessie's Jetpack Sneakers, that was one of my favorites. She's got a pair of sneakers that, you know, she's about to whoosh away, and she's got a button in her dress. And it's just all these wonderful rhymes. The tiger in my belly, oh my goodness. That one was really one that really just inspired a lot of, I can do it. I am going to, you know, call within myself to get the energy and the power I need to do maybe scary things or things that require me to put myself out there. And I could go on and on and on about this one, but The Dragon Pinata, that one was my absolute favorite. But beware of the dragon pinata, friends, should it ever cross your path. If you swing a bat at a mythical beast, you might end up feeling its wrath. So it's like, it's just a scene at a birthday party where grandma's with the cat and, you know, the cat gets, you know, sort of put off by the dragon. It's just beautiful. And I can't say enough either about the illustrations that go with this book. The one where Wild, Doug Salati is just, I mean, these illustrations are just stunning. And I will say that overall, the book, the whole format, the way it was designed, if there were an award for, you know, Shel Silverstein worthy-ish, this would be it. This is just a beautiful, beautiful book. So I hope you will pick it up for readings with your children and families. And adults can read it on their own, too, as I have a couple times now.
Yeah, the best kind. I think that book looks like It looks so much like a book I would have picked up in the library in like 1981,
yes.
82,
yes,
it 83.
Does. It's very Maurice Sendak.
Very. Slightly muted, like brighter. I don't know. There's like a softness to the colors, even though there's orange and yellow on the cover.
Yeah.
It looks very vintage.
Yes.
Like
I agree.
Retro.
I agree.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like something that's been here forever.
Yeah.
And that's, and the complete opposite of like commercialized art, you know what I mean? Or
right.
illustrations that are,
right.
it just looks very real.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's beautiful,
and it's all in color inside as well. It's just it's gorgeous.
It really is. It looks like a classic. Mm-hmm. And moving on, I'm going to talk about one that to me seems very similar. This is Rumpelstiltskin, retold by Mac Barnett and illustrated by Carson Ellis. Again, a multi-award winning author and illustrator team on this one, and Mac Barnett. Books in particular, I just always love yeah. Extra Yarn. You know, there's so many you can go, I won't go into all of them. But when I was a child, I had a few of those classic stories that were my favorite. And my probably my absolute favorite was Rumpelstiltskin. It was just so scary. And I love how the child in the story, or the woman is rather eventually, is victorious. Over this horrible little creature, and he's just so creepy, and he stamps his little foot. It's like a little tantruming little guy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just so beautifully done, gorgeous illustrations. They said they were inspired by, they both love Tudor history, and they were inspired by an art gallery, and that's what the pictures look like these beautiful pieces. But they intersperse these gorgeous colored plates with old woodblock, and again, that harkens back to the books a lot of the books we had when we were young were black and white, and they had a few color plates, or like they were like blue colored. You know, it was like less color on each page than a lot of books. And it's just beautiful. It's got a lot of wit, pretty faithful to the original story with a few twists. It's got that humor and just a really empowering story, ultimately, about really great peril and our main character overcoming it in this very witty way. And what I really loved about it, and I don't remember this in the tellings when I was a child, is that I really think her love of nature pulls into the story, and in the story, if you read it, you'll see that she goes out into the woods with her baby, and that is when the solution to the problem reveals itself. She goes out where she spent a lot of time in the woods as a child with nature, and I thought that was a really interesting twist and probably intentional. I read it twice, and on the second reading, all this kind of symbolism came out to me that I don't know if a child would pick up on, but the
funny
adult reading
that
with them, yeah, and I thought, wow, maybe I'm reading into this. It doesn't really matter. That's what we get to do as a reader, but I don't think so. I think that was intentional.
Yeah.
And so I don't really want to give too much away, but I encourage adults and children to check this one out.
Yeah. It's kind of neat. A few days ago, Cheryl and I were talking about how, like, sometimes when you read a book again or you see a movie again, it doesn't hit you the same way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if you really loved it the first time, and then you go back and like, well, what was I thinking? And just like it. So I'm someone, you know, as a child, I was very naive and didn't think that it was worth it to watch a movie again or to read a book again because there's so much more to get through. But especially now that you get older and there's so many things you love.
Yeah.
And you want to be friends with those and you visit them again.
Yeah.
And it might not be exactly the same, but I love just going back and doing second and third and fourth readings when you can. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And seeing what resonates.
Yeah.
And it's really exciting when it really resonates. You're like, wow, now I see this in a different light with this 20
Absolutely.
Years on me, but it's even more special. Or, I could see why I loved this when I was 13.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really hit for me anymore.
And it's okay for that 13-year-old.
Goodbye. Right. Yeah, right? Exactly.
But I think I've talked about that, too, in terms of just in my issues with reading, kind of post-pandemic. And given everything going on in the world, I tend to have more trouble starting something new when I don't know kind of where it's going. And feel very comfortable. We were talking about the tabs in our books, like marking up different spots in our books.
Yeah.
And I told them I go back and visit, just to make sure that my favorite parts are still there.
Yeah.
And it is sort of, there's a comfort to that. And and it is fascinating kind of, the ones that I go back to the most right now are one thing, but to kind of go and look at older ones and sort of, again, see if they still resonate the same way is quite interesting.
And music too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's so exciting. Absolutely. When something you haven't listened to in a while still hits you or hits you in a new way.
Yes.
And then it's also like, oh yeah, I really don't know what I was thinking when I liked this music, but I can kind of see that person and I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I told her the other side of that is that then I will listen to, you know, I'll put it away for a while and I'll come back to it again. Like, oh no, I get it now again. The time is hitting me just a little different today. And I can sing that one with full throated. I don't know. It is interesting the way it really depends on how it hits us and when.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads me to my book for this little round, which is I want to talk about The Wayward Children series by Shannon McGuire. This is actually the 11th book, just came out in January, which is, I always have to look at these titles because they're great. Through Gates of Garnet and Gold is the 11th book, but I'll start back at the beginning. The first book was Every Heart a Doorway. This is a series sort of based in the idea of, it really focuses on those children that wander off, whether it be Alice down the rabbit hole or the Pevensies into the wardrobe or, you know, all of those poor old children and that idea that they have their adventures and then get dumped back home. And what do? You've lived almost a whole lifetime in this other world, and then you get dumped back into the real world. So in this series, McGuire introduces Eleanor West's Home for Wayward Children, which is a sort of a school and a haven that allows children time to readjust or possibly just wait out their door reappearing, maybe possibly getting back into the world that they got bumped out of. The sign on the door, there's a sign on the gate for the school that says, no solicitations, no visitors, and no quests. Two out of three happen in every book. There's always a quest. And you've got this group of children who have been doing that sort of thing in other worlds, and just weird things keep happening. You get introduced to these characters who come from different worlds. They're not all going off to the same world. There's different types of these worlds, some more serious, some more magical than others. But it's sort of figuring out how to deal with it, figuring out if it's going back is actually the answer to their story. But there's always a smaller story going on in each. They're novellas. It's a really witty series. It can be whimsical, it can be scary. Some of the worlds are really dark. It's always weird, but the characters are wonderful. Every Heart of Dory won the Nebula, the Hugo, Locust Award. It is also an Alex Award winner, the first book. And one of the things, kind of harkening back to this last conversation, is one of the things about it is I am so impressed with the development of the story that each, or even maybe even every few books, you sort of look back at the first book and think, oh, it's harkened back to, and they're novellas, it harkens back to the story and you sort of thinking, that's a totally different angle than what I thought was going on, or there's so much more to the story than I realized was going to be. The fact that this has gone on 11 books and there's just this overarching story that's developing is really quite neat, in her ability to create and keep these characters alive and keep the sort of story sort of spiraling, and it's very interesting.
Yeah.
So people, if you haven't kept up with the series, the 11th book almost pulls back directly to the first book in some interesting ways, and I'm very curious to see where it's going to go next.
That sounds really interesting. And you wonder how much of that they had in the beginning.
Yes, you do.
And then how much is, how authors say that the characters are sort of writing the story,
yeah,
you know, themselves in a way.
Often I feel like, and I don't know the answer for Shona McGuire, but often I feel like they don't know. It's very rare that I've come across a person who can, where I can solidly, in retrospect, see that there is no way they could not have known, because you needed everything to happen to get the joke in this book.
you know,
then the third book, or there's a couple of series where I can think of like that. But it's interesting. And there are only so many series I really stick with. Mm. And this is one. And I it's sort of like clockwork, and every January you get the next book. I have a friend who rereads every one, like right up until the next book is coming out.
Wow.
And it's a good series. It pulls cool. from, you get that feel from all this. I mean, portal fantasies are really quite popular. It's sort of, and it pulls from those ideas. And
yeah. All right.
So I highly recommend them.
Very cool. I have two books that I'm going to do in succession that are very different, but there is a thread, and the thread is the power of nature and to inspire, and in particular, birds, I would say, in both books as well. So the first one is one that I think people are going to be hearing about this year. It's called The Company of Owls, a memoir by Polly Atkin. It was first published in England. And this is a book, a memoir about a woman who lives in the Lake District in Cumbria in England, and she has multiple chronic illnesses, and she remembers living in this house and hearing owls at night, and literally having owls like at the window type of a thing. And as the story progresses, she gets to move back to the Lake District and ends up being able to sight some tawny owls in the woods, and little owlets in particular. And on her Instagram, you can see pictures of them, and there's like nothing cuter than these fuzzy little owlets. Oh my gosh. And it's just a really quiet story about going out and seeing them and kind of feeling that kind of, not privilege is a funny word, but in a way, but having that opportunity to sort of build this odd relationship with them, in the sense that she gets to see them and she gets to see them fledge a bit. And it's kind of talks about owls through literature, owls in England, owl conservation, different species of owls in England, and then this thread of personal story as well. It's a quiet book. It's really grounding, and just one of those books where she pulls from the owl's lives some fortification for her own life and acceptance of her life as somebody who can't really get up in the morning and do things. She's a night owl. She is very limited physically by her condition and has had to accept a different life than she'd maybe wanted or sought out for herself. So it's just one of those really lovely, lyrical, poetic memoirs, lots of great nature details. So I recommend that. And I think you'll be seeing this sort of in more indie book circles. It'll be, I think, on some of the end of your list, is my guess, The Company of Owls. So just a lovely book. And the second one that I have is called Night Flyer, Harriet Tubman and the Faith Dreams of a Free People by Taya Miles. And if you've listened to our podcast, many episodes, you'll be no stranger to Taya Miles, because Jessica and I have talked.
We like Taya Miles.
Yeah, we do. She actually has a book called Dawn of Detroit that I really, really want to read. I haven't read that one yet. But I talked about All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, a number of years ago. Jessica talked about Wild Girls. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, probably now. Mm-hmm. This is a 2024 book, Night Flyer, and I'm so glad I read this. I mean, it was so incredibly informative. I really give her a lot of kudos, because it's hard to write books about Harriet Tubman, really, because there isn't a written record from Harriet Tubman about her own life. And so I feel like she pulled from all these different areas, but she also has a specific goal with this book. She wants to pull Harriet Tubman and out of the realm of superhero. Not that she wasn't super heroic, but to pull her away from that, because there's a little bit of a making her into something sort of mythic,
right.
Person who's mythic.
Absolutely.
Does a couple
yep.
things, right?
Yep.
It sort of degrades her humanity, but it mm-hmm. also doesn't allow her to be somebody that people right now can tap into as well and use for their own, yeah. as inspiration for their own journey, mm-hmm. especially with civil rights or social injustice. Mm-hmm. And so there's many reasons, but she also focuses in particular on her faith, her great, incredible faith, and that was a guiding mission. She really, Harriet Tubman, felt that she was acting, God sent her to help. Mm-hmm. You know, she was praying for justice for her people, for end to horrible suffering and death and mistreatment, and she realized that she had to go. That was the solution. It wasn't going to be like a bolt of lightning. So that's a piece of it, but also nature. She really wants to tap into the theological and naturalistic, ecological heritage of Black women in particular, and of Harriet Tubman, and how she had to know everything about woods, tracking, wind, weather, animals, because of those extremely large journeys she did on foot. So that those are the two pieces. And she also links the story to other Black women, evangelical leaders. She's done some research on them. So there's a little bit of that in there, too, and she does parallels. A couple things. You really have to read this book because there's so much in here. It's just phenomenal. But she talks a little bit about an archives at the University of Michigan libraries that she found out about after the book was done, and about some of the information that she got from that, and it was really, really incredible. And one of the things I'm just going to leave you with, because it's a book you really have to read, but she talked about how through these letters that are in these archives at U of M, and there are the archives of an abolitionist and a suffragist who knew Harriet Tubman. But at the end of Harriet Tubman's life, she had a home in New York, and she took in all these people. And it's just, wow. She took in blind people, sick people, abandoned children, and she had this home full of people. And that's just a story you don't usually hear, you know?
Right.
And they lived with her in their home. And this suffragist was like kind of like, it's different, you know, like you're sort of, not disparaging, but just sort of like, yeah, she just sort of collects these people, you know, but it was just so beautiful, really,
right.
You know, and says so much about her. And I see why she's seen as heroic, because she was,
right.
But it humanizes her too.
Right.
So I'm not going to say more about it. It's an excellent book. It took me a couple of years to read, and I'm just so glad I did. You'll notice I put it on a lot of lists, and that's why I really want to promote it. Mm-hmm. People pick it up.
Absolutely.
So. Nice. So I have the next book. It is a picture book, nonfiction book. It is The Dream Builder's Blueprint, Dr. King's Message to Young People. It's by Alice Faye Duncan, and it was illustrated by E.B. Lewis. And this is actually a picture book that is based on a speech that Dr. King gave at Barat Junior High School in South Philadelphia, and this would have occurred in October of 1967. Dr. King did not speak at a lot of schools, as far as I can have done my little bit of research, but this was something that really inspired me to go back, because there's a recording of this speech, so I got to see it on YouTube. And what Alice Faye Duncan does is take that speech, and she creates what is called an erasure poem, which I was not that familiar with, but basically, you know, think of, you know, a famous speech or, you know, a sermon or something that has really inspired you. And you take that piece of, you know, that chunk of words, and you take away words, and you have something that could be considered a poem of some kind. So that's what she has done. And this speech really, you know, Dr. King starts out by asking, you know, what's your life's blueprint? You know, how is your life being built? Who is your architect? What is, you know, what's the structure for what will become your building? And it was just so inspiring, first of all, just to hear him speak, but then to go through this book with the words that she took away. There's just, you know, a blueprint serves as the pattern for those building a building. And I was just really struck by how much, you know, we see Dr. King as someone who's really fighting and like a big superstar, obviously, of the civil rights movement, but also just like there were so many parts to the book and in the speech where, you know, he's, you know, talking about if you can't be a tree, then be a bush. You know, if you can't be a road, then be a trail. I just really appreciated this inspirational bit of, like, you know, be the best you can be, do everything with excellence, you have worth and you have dignity. And something that showed up in his speech as well as in the book, the principle of being your own somebody-ness, that you are somebody. And of course, I thought recently, I've been thinking a lot about the late Jesse Jackson, mm-hmm. and just how much, like, he inspires both worth, in, you know, personally, internally, but also seeing the rest of the world as really worthwhile and worthy of doing everything you can do to be the best for your community. And he does end that way, like, you know, really don't just do something for yourself or for your family or for what you think of as your own community, but for the world, for your country. It's not just about you. So I really, really love this book. I'm going to say that probably one of my favorite illustrations is the one about make a better world. And there are no page numbers on this, but study, burn the midnight oil, don't drop out of school. E.B. Lewis just does such a beautiful job of just the colors and the pop. I mean, you can't see this, sorry podcast people, but it's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Seeing someone like looking out into the world with the stars and the sky and on the pops of color with the rays of sunshine. Just a beautiful, beautiful book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, my next book is also from a poet, so that's the loose tie, but it's much more internal. I want to talk about The Flower Bearers by poet Rachel Eliza Griffiths. This is beautiful, gut-wrenching memoir. It deals with soul-deep grief and mental health. The story kind of unravels slowly, starting with Griffith's wedding day, swinging back to her meeting her soon-to-be husband, Salman Rushdie, and back further to meeting really her heart's sister, the poet Camilla Aisha Moon, when they were students at Sarah Lawrence College. And then it kind of swings back to her wedding day when, after the service, she's finally told that Moon died that morning and was not able to make it. She'd been missing. She knew something was wrong. But nobody let her know that Moon had died until they knew she would get through the ceremony, but she shattered, absolutely shattered at that time. And then 11 months later was the attack on Salman Rushdie at the Chautauqua Institute. So this is a mixture of a testament, this is a healing journey, it's a little bit of a memorial, it's just a beautifully written memoir of grief, of pulling oneself back together. You get a beautiful view of this woman's lives together as best friends, their poetry tribe, and writer tribe is ever present, there's the very odd and interesting dynamic between her and Rushdie, who is much older, and this is I think it's his fifth wife, but they have this beautiful connection, and I think with his story, which he talks about in his own book, but from her point of view, it's sort of in the beginning you have that kind of feeling, like when she's introducing him to her father, happens in the book, and he's sort of, you get the impression that everybody thought he was past the point where it was really that his past wouldn't infringe on their life together. And that didn't work out the way they both expected. But it's I will say I listened to this. It's a wonderful audiobook. And it's just a beautiful story. But it is heartbreaking. She truly shatters with the loss of Moon. So it's a really beautiful book, and I would highly suggest it.
That one sounds so good. Mm-hmm. Jessica and I got to hear the author talk at a library event that we go to, it was like book marketers, and oh, she was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to move on to my last book of our podcast today, and I'm going to start out by saying this is a nonfiction book that reads like a traditional nonfiction book. But I want to make a case. If you start to read a book and you really don't like it, I'd say put it down. But here and there, I personally like to stick with the book. I don't if I start it and I don't like it. There's just too many books to read. But if I'm in it a while and I realize it's just a slog, it's totally okay to put it down. But sometimes I like to try to stick with it. I don't think you have to. I'm glad I did because it's just the particular writing style. It's very different than other books that I've read. Some just are stickier. There's a lot more names in them. There are more dates. There are battles, that sort of thing. And this one fits that category. But I'm so glad I read it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's called Every Valley, The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah. Sorry, I have a hard time not saying Handel now that I, I bet everybody calls him Handel here, so I will. By Charles King. And Charles King is a Georgetown professor. He wrote Gods of the Upper Air, which I also didn't read, about anthropologists. That was a bigger book a number of years ago. So it has an academic style, but it is very readable. I just want to say, too, I'm not a music expert. I'm not even I don't really know anything about classical music. So if I say something a little funny, it's because I don't have any knowledge in this area. I just read this book. So I don't think this is a book for somebody who's obsessed with, opera in particular or classical music. I think it has interest for people who are interested in learning more about the Messiah, but it's more of one of those books that pulls in. It sets the stage of how an event, in this case, Handel's Messiah, came about in a historical context with people and different actual stories and narratives of different people, sort of group biography. Okay, so the setting of this book is mid-18th century England. This is a really rough time, and it was nasty. We've got the transatlantic slave trade, which is funding the coffers of everything in England and in overseas, we'll say. And it's highly problematic. Massive poverty, classism, just kind of a brutal, nasty, sarcastic, satirical style even in media. Child infant mortality is super high. But it's supposedly the Enlightenment. So we have some writers and ideas, and we're starting to... But the idea of optimism wasn't really a thing. And there was just a lot of darkness. And people did love entertainment. They liked opera. They liked performances. They really liked that sort of thing. I learned from this book that the Messiah is an oratorio. I learned that word. I did not know that. But so it takes you into this time. We have the Great Pretender. We have the Jacobites, the Hanoverians, which was shocking to me. I know I've heard of this English history, but this book really brought it to life. We have instability, threat of war, just danger, sickness. And here comes this piece of work that really was not written by Handel. It was written by a man named Jennens. And this is an extremely depressive person who lost a brother to suicide. And he's really struggling for what the point of life is. And he pores over all these texts, and he creates the libretto that becomes Handel's Messiah. And he gives it to Handel, and Handel makes this piece, which debuts in London. And everybody feels like there's something really different about this. And at its heart, it's a story of hope. It's a story of a different way to live, of something that rises above. And so the author, Charles King, in the middle of the pandemic, he's had some personal losses. There's a lot going on. And he and his wife are kind of stuck in their apartment, and they put on Handel's Messiah. And they start crying. And they're so moved by it. And that's kind of how this book came about. We meet a whole bunch of different characters in it. I'll be talking way too long if I go into it much more. But it brings that period alive. Mm-hmm. And I love that about this book. It's a little dense, but I'm so glad I read it. And I really have a new appreciation for this piece of literature. And it's one of those books that brings London at that time to life, which, as you probably know, I have a real interest in London. So, but I do recommend you read it. If you like music, if you like history, if you like really interesting narrative nonfiction, this would fit in that vein.
My next book is The Danger to the Minds of Young Girls, Margaret C. Anderson, Book Bans and the Fight to Modernize Literature. This is a biography of Anderson, who was a queer, headstrong, socialite-ish type person who decided she was not, she was from Indiana, kind of slightly well-off family, didn't want to kind of stick around, get married and do that sort of thing, decided she was going to run off to Chicago and start a literary journal. She did it on her parents' dime for a little while until she kind of ticked them off, and then she figured out how to make it work on her own. She was the kind of personality that would, I would keep, one of the kind of recurring stories in this, or comments in this, is that she would like stomp her way in, or not stomp, she would walk into a particular piano company store front and say, "I will run ads for your company in my journal if you give me a grand piano for my apartment." And she did it more than once, and they did it. And it's just one of those, she was just, yeah. She comes off as a very interesting personality. But what she created was the Little Review, with help from a few other people. It's an avant-garde literary journal. She was based in Chicago for the early years, but it featured experimental works of Ezra Pound, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, E.E. Cummings. But it also featured the first six chapters of Ulysses by Joyce. So she kept coming up against the censors, United States censors, until she was actually brought to trial over it. And so the book kind of goes through, it really is, looks at her life in total, but it focuses on the book banning or the censorship trials dealing with Ulysses. But it is fascinating to see, again, the tribes that of authors that surrounded this and the overlaps. The Square Haunting, yeah, kind of happened. It's the same time. Same overlapping group of people. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating kind of just to hear. Almost in a Gatsby kind of way. It is, yes, fascinating to kind of just kind of hear how all of these people lived and intermixed and how the stories went. But it also, as you kind of step back and think about, boy, we're just seeing yet another bill out there to ban books, yeah, at a federal level, and it's a never ending cycle. Yeah. It feels like. So this is just, it's a very interesting take on it. It's a lighter, this is Nusslog, this is a lighter book, but it was very interesting. It's just interesting to kind of see that view of it, and you know, I don't know how you feel about your early history lessons in elementary, but we tended to not get this far. This is sort of between the teens and, yeah, World War II, and you know, it's, you, yeah, just, that's a period that we didn't, mm-hmm, ever kind of get to, or we fast-forwarded through it.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating period.
Right.
That interests me so much.
Right. And she ends up, you know, she's based in Chicago, ends up in New York for a while, and then actually ends up going into Europe and making a life there. So it is an interesting, and being actually caught in Europe during World War II and having to try to figure out. So it's just an interesting run, yeah, of stories and how the lives are intertwined.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to hear authors, mm-hmm, that you've heard about in a context like,
yes,
that, in,
yes,
a group.
Yeah,
it's not a group biography, but having that.
But it functions as one in a way,
dropping,
because he really,
yeah,
does kind of spend some time on, because like specifically Ezra Pound was very, yeah, deeply involved with the Little Review. So it's, and so you get a fair amount of his life as part of this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sounds like quite the character.
Yes, he does. Definitely. So it was a very interesting story. Go ahead.
Okay, so this is Maddie, and I have my last book. It is a novel in verse, A Year Without Home, by V.T. Badania. This was absolutely fascinating. It is in the fiction section, but it's kind of a memoir in some ways. In 1975, the Vietnam War ended, and this family who was living in Laos crossed the Mekong River in Laos and escaped to Thailand because it was a very distraught time in their history where there was a lot of the threat of communism taking over. And this family crossed over because the father was involved with the military and had been helping the Americans. So they start their journey to a refugee camp. They end up in a refugee camp in Thailand. And Gao Sheng is our narrator, or our person who is telling us the story of her family. She is from a Hmong family. She ends up, she's in a family of four sisters and a son. And this is just a really fascinating look at the journey of her family coming from leaving Laos and then coming over to the United States. But it's just like a window into a young 11 or 12 year old girl who is going through all these things as being the oldest child. She is like really asked to take care of her siblings in this story, and she has so many feelings inside that she's absolutely loving her peaches on her mountain. She saves these peach seeds that she has to leave. The beginning of the book is just set up completely with this incredible love story to her home on the mountain before they leave Laos. The dog, the horse, her going to school, just this beautiful, beautiful story of describing her lush community. I think I was really drawn to this book because she has a lot of, there are a lot of themes of, I guess you could say, patriarchy in that time in history in her family, where she's like called upon to do all these things, to serve her brother, to serve her father, because that was just the way of the culture and the community. And just this major stirring of within her that's just like, why can't I ever do the fun things? Why do I have to do these things to help? And always feeling like she's having to take care of kids because all her sisters are, they're little, they're really tiny. And I was reading an article with the author who, you find out that really this story is told from the author's older sister's point of view. So the author is actually one of the baby sisters, in reality. But I just, this was just, it was just, I both read it and listened to it. I highly recommend doing both, maybe reading it first and then listening to it slowly. It is just, the voice is so powerful. And I think what I love the most was just her desire to have a voice for herself, to build up and to speak up when she wants to do things. She's lost friends, best friends, and has not been able to express, how much that has hurt her. I want to recommend also the Astrid and Apollo series, as well as the Extraordinary Eliana series. This is by the same author, V.T. Badania. That's kind of like an early reader. And I guess for me, I just feel like the Hmong community in youth literature is very underrepresented. Mm-hmm. And in the Lansing area, there may not be a lot of Hmong, but they are here. And I hope that they know that if they, want to, see themselves reflected in these books, we have them in our library. Mm-hmm. So, that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. I got the last one. And I'm bringing Custodians of Wonder, Ancient Customs, Profound Traditions, and the Last People Keeping Them Alive by Elliot Stein. This is a book, it took me a while. It came out in 2024, and I've had it off and on as an audio book and a physical book. It's really fascinating. I really enjoyed it. I mostly just kept getting interrupted with things that I was supposed to be reading, in quotes. as opposed to what I wanted to be reading. But this is, it is the author going around and exploring the stories. It's 10 different stories, 10 different experiences. It's the last living libraries of West Africa, Scandinavian's last night watchman, the last Inca bridge master, the world's rarest pasta, the mirror that reveals your truest self, these pure mirrors that are made in India, Asia's last film poster painter. They literally was down at the time of doing this book. There were only three that he knew of poster painters for cinemas in the world, which used to be instead of these vinyl things that they throw up and mass produce, or LD, or you know, LCD, excuse me, or screens. There is a chapter called "Where Bees Are Part of the Family" about the tradition of going and telling the bees, which I did not know about, and it was fascinating. There's one that's called "The Only Democratic Job in Cuba," which is the readers at the cigar factories, and the man trying to save Japanese food, which is about the original Japanese soy sauce, which is not what we see in the world anymore, and the most romantic job in Europe, which is about a postman. There is a tree in, in Germany that has a hole that is its own postal location. That people send their people in search of romance, send their letters to this tree. The postman delivers to this tree, and people will go, come and go. They can climb up and pull letters out and possibly come up with a match. And so they're all fascinating. They're all, and at this point, I don't know. I mean, he was sort of doing this in 21 and 22. You kind of have to wonder what of this even still exists in that short period of time, because he's down to really kind of the last people for all of these. The soy sauce one was fascinating, because you just get this idea of these, you get the feel of these fermenting barrels that they no longer make anymore, and the guy has learned, he's like, he wanted to replace barrels and realized that the company that used to make the barrels doesn't make barrels anymore, and there's only one guy left who can make the barrels, and once that's gone, then there's no doing this. So he learned how to make the barrels, and he runs workshops on how to make the barrels, but he's not sure if he will ever get enough people to keep this going. So it's become sort of one of those, it's more of a foodie, special food product that you know can barely get anywhere, but it's the only way to kind of keep this tradition alive. And it is, I mean, it's a heritage, it's a cultural heritage thing, world cultural heritage.
And UNESCO heritage site?
Yes, yes, okay. A designated thing. And a number of these things are.
Wow.
So it's just very interesting to kind of see these last people and how they're doing it, and whether they think it's going to continue, or and how some of them do reach out and try to teach in hopes that somebody will take over. The bridge builder by itself, I mean, it's somebody who's literally stringing together bridges over, I mean, it's just sort of like, I don't even want to know. I don't want to, I didn't want to look down and I was reading the book. You know, it's sort of, it's very, very interesting, the range of the stories. So again, this was a fascinating listen, and I would highly recommend it.
It sounds so good. There was something about cake and bees that Jessica told me about.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, and that's the thing. Is that I've heard there is one of the Diana Gabaldon books has "Go Tell the Bees I'm Gone," I think.
Okay.
And I guess I've heard "Go Tell the Bees" in passing, but I never knew what that meant. And yes, it's fairly uniquely British, and certain areas of Britain that have kept it alive, though it did come to the States and to Appalachia, I think, in particular. but it's people who it became a thing to announce the world's events or the community's events to the bees, and it was thought that if you didn't do that, you wouldn't get the honey. It would be detrimental to the community. So you tell them of deaths and you tell them of births. You bring them a cake, a piece of the cake, when the marriage. You run the guy by, you know, you run the guy by the bees on some, in some cases. It's
Yeah, I'm thinking of a book we read last year in my book group. I think it was He Should Have Told the Bees by Amanda Cox. Same sort of things, like this idea of sharing things that are about to happen or going to be happening in your family with your bee community.
And you have these people sort of saying, I don't know if there's anything to it, but I got all this honey, and this person never talked to the bees, and they didn't get this honey. So, or it's or even the person kind of witnessing Elliot Stein kind of going with the woman that he's interviewing, the first woman that he's interviewing, and she takes him to one of their colonies, and part of the story is to announce a new birth, and he just feels like everything kind of still, they all came out to her and then they all went back in. And it's sort of like a moment of like, you don't know if it could be a coincidence. It could be real. You don't really know. Yeah. So.
So cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, it's a variety. And I'm reading a lot of nonfiction for the fiction selector. But
I want to read a lot of fiction. So we've really crossed.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Also, I'm just rereading a lot because that's comfortable lately. So everybody go read, have fun, read whatever is comfortable for you, read whatever age level is comfortable for you, just read, have fun with it.
Yep.
Happy reading.
Happy reading. Happy March is reading.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, every month is reading.